May it please the court, Dan Benson. I represent Metalclad. I'm arguing on behalf of the petitioners. My colleague, Sean Morgan, represents Paramount. She'll also be arguing on behalf of the petitioners during rebuttal. To that end, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. This argument also, Your Honor, we have a visual aid that I've handed to the bailiff. There's copies for each of the judges. I've handed a copy to opposing counsel as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. If Deggs was right, then the trial court got it wrong. Just 5 months ago, this court issued a decision in Deggs versus Asbestos Corporation Limited and held that where the statute of limitations expires on the decedent's underlying personal injury claim, that bars a subsequent wrongful death action by his estate. The trial court's decision to deny the petitioner's motion for summary judgment is in direct conflict with this court's decision in Deggs, and for that reason, the trial court should be reversed. The trial court was clearly wrong for two reasons. First, the trial court was wrong with respect to the survival actions. The estate of Barabin brought survival actions, and in fact, if you look at clerk's paper number 425 in the record, the estate and the personal injury in action, and the trial court level conceded that the survival action was barred. Yet, for some reason, despite the fact that it was undisputed by the parties, the court denied the petitioner's motions to dismiss, or summary judgment motions to dismiss, the survival action claim. In addition, the court was wrong with respect to the wrongful death action, and that's really what the briefing is focused on in this case.
It looks like the trial court leaned heavily upon the order of Judge Robar from the federal court, and those both seem to focus on, you know, the linchpin of this whole theory that has been advanced by Deggs, the majority in Deggs, goes back to these cases that were dealing with fume exposure under the Factory Act and the basic premise that if you have any right to recovery, it's under the Factory Act. And so that's all outdated, outmoded, distinguishable. So we really, the whole starting point that you don't have a viable wrongful death cause of action if you haven't met the statute of limitations for the personal injury claim really is unfounded.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I think the trial court was wrong in that regard for a couple of reasons. First, as this court's majority decision in Deggs noted in a footnote, the standard that Judge Robart was evaluating in the federal court was the fraudulent joinder standard. So Judge Robart says in that order, which is also in the record, that it very well may be that the defendants had a viable statute of limitations defense. Just on the broad fraudulent joinder standard, he wasn't going to be the one to decide that. So Judge Rule was taking a step further and evaluating a different standard. The second thing is that Judge Rule isn't allowed to ignore Supreme Court decisions just because they're old. And the underlying tort, the underlying personal injury tort that was at issue doesn't affect the principle. If you look at the visual aid that's been handed to the court, you'll see you have a wide variety of, you know, Calhoun and Grant, those cases did involve exposure to fumes, but Johnson didn't. White involved exposure to asbestos. Wills involved medical malpractice. But the court's jurisprudence, both the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals jurisprudence, has been uniform. No matter what the underlying tort is, if the decedent takes action during his lifetime that somehow forfeits his personal injury claim, whether that's settlement, whether that's obtaining a favorable judgment, whether that's choosing not to sue certain defendants like we have in this case and allowing the statute of limitations to expire, in those situations, which is the same situation that this court addressed in Deggs, the court said his estate can't then bring a wrongful death action.
Although the estate actually is kind of a nominal party. It's by the personal representative on behalf of the statutory beneficiary. So you kind of have different parties, and you have different damages. And so when someone starts to say this really isn't that derivative of the personal injury claim, isn't there something to that?
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I think, first of all, that there's quite a bit of overlap between the damages, and it's not really all that clear. In this case, even less so than Deggs, because in the Barabin action, the personal injury action, Mr. Barabin's wife, who is also the personal representative and the for his estate, who's bringing the wrongful death action for her benefit, also brought a loss of consortium claim and actually received the $1.5 million verdict from the jury for loss of consortium in the personal injury action. Now, that verdict has been reversed by the Ninth Circuit, so the personal injury action is still pending. But it goes to the point that we're not necessarily talking about always two entirely separate measures of damages. Now, there are some
There are differences, though, and there may be a legitimate argument they're de minimis, but funeral expenses, is that the acid test here, the litmus test? If that's a damage these statutory beneficiaries cannot recover, why should they not be able to recover that just because the statute of limitations ran on the personal injury claim? It has nothing to do with funeral expenses.
Well, Your Honor, though I agree with the court's statement that the two actions are independent and not the same, and that some of the measures of damages are different, where I disagree and where this court has disagreed in Deggs and where the Supreme Court disagreed in Calhoun is to say that because they're separate causes of action, it means they're unrelated. But just because two causes of actions are separate, it doesn't mean they're unrelated. If they were unrelated...
What do you think? I mean, there's a policy judgment that's been made here in the Calhoun line of cases. What is it? I mean, is the concern that there's going to be a windfall to the plaintiffs because they'll get double recovery? And if that's the concern, isn't that adequately addressed by the point that Judge Dwyer made in his dissent, saying that that can be handled by jury instructions?
I believe, Your Honor...
What is the problem here? What is the judgment that was made back at the time of Calhoun and that you're espousing today that is the foundation for this rule?
Yes, Your Honor. I think with respect to the policy judgment here, there is more to it than the potential for double recovery, though I do think that's a real issue. And I also respectfully disagree with Judge Dwyer's dissenting opinion that it would be a very, could easily be resolved with an instruction, because it's not at all clear the easy way in which one would ensure that there wasn't double recovery between, say, a personal injury loss of consortium claim, particularly in this case where the personal injury action is going to be decided when the jury already knows that the decedent has passed away, and then the damages measure that they're going to apply, another jury is going to apply in a wrongful death action. But I think in addition to the threat of double recovery, you also have, as this court addressed in Deggs, the interest in the finality of judgments and the preservation of evidence, and not having a situation which would not be uncommon in a lot of different underlying torts, whether asbestos or not, where the injury-causing event happens, say, 30 years earlier, there's a collection or a settlement. Your Honor, may I have time to respond?
You may.
Thank you. There's a collection, a personal judgment, a settlement, or something, or a litigation decision made years before the decedent dies, and then, 30 years later when the decedent dies, then the estate can come and litigate a whole new claim. So there is a finality of judgments and preservation of evidence policy, along with the potential for double recovery, and not keeping the wrongful death action untethered from the personal injury action, which helps the speedy resolution of settlements and efficient resolution of disputes. With that, I reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court, Lloyd Leroy for the respondents, the Berriman Bears. The court is absolutely correct in the questions that have been asked here. Why?
You haven't heard my questions for you, though.
That's quite all right, Your Honor, because I'm prepared to answer them. But
my first question is, are you in the wrong court in the sense that...
No, Your Honor, because we have to be here first.
Okay.
All right. We're not in the wrong court. We have to be here first. And Judge Dwyer recognized that in his opinion. He can't overturn it. You can't overturn it. But you're all aware that it makes no sense. It is topsy-turvy land. You have to sue for wrongful death 8 years before a death. Oh, but you can't because there's no personal representative to do that because one can't be appointed until there's a death. Oh, but it's barred.
But isn't the point of Calhoun and Grant real, and a lot of the cases do talk in terms of accrual, but isn't the concept, it really isn't accrual, it's just, does this claim exist?
Well,
does it continue to exist? Is it viable? Has it been extinguished? Is it
the claim exists because the legislature says it exists. It says that the wrongful act of a person which causes a death creates a cause of action for the heirs. So that cause of action exists. The question is whether you can assert it. And the court says, no, you can't assert it because the injured person didn't assert it. Wait, The injured person couldn't assert it because it didn't accrue. And that's the key. It did not accrue until the time of death. Case law in Washington says that. A cause of death, a wrongful death cause of action accrues at the time of death.
Johnson seems to characterize it as one of a number of equitable limitations on being able to pursue a wrongful death action, this statutory action. There are equitable limits on that.
Johnson, says there was a limitation on the spouse because she couldn't sue her husband, but there was no limitation on the heirs because that was a personal disability to the spouse. Once she died, that disability didn't exist any longer. So they were free to proceed. That's what Johnson said. Again, it's topsy-turvy land. It doesn't make any sense that you can't bring a wrongful death action.
Well, what about the circumstance that counsel was just describing that is an example of perhaps the policy judgment was one that goes with the statute of limitations, the stale claim? For instance, you have a person who is becomes ill or injured at a fairly young age and has a personal injury claim and settles it. So then years go by and he dies because of the wrongful act that caused the injury. All the witnesses are dead too, and now the heirs come along and say, well, now we want to bring up the same act and we want to prove the negligence caused us some different damages. So isn't it plausible that that's what the Supreme Court had in mind and that's what the whole... This is the equity that it rests on, is a desire to put statute of limitations policies into this accrual.
It's certainly plausible, Your Honor, but it doesn't fit with the scenario in Calhoun or in Grant or in Johnson. Those were no young person dying 30 years later. Those were relatively immediate events. And moreover, the problem that's created by that hypothetical is easily solved by the measure of damages issue. What are the, if someone was injured and someone recovered and 30 years later they die from that injury, did the spouse marry that disability? And if so, are they not barred from recovering? What did the heirs lose as a result of that injury? And that's what the wrongful death action is about. It's about the heir's damages. If you shoot my wife, yes, you have really injured her, but you have injured me as well if you kill her. You've destroyed my life. That's the cause of action that the legislature gave to the citizens of Washington.
That particular cause of action accrues rather rapidly because there's a sudden death and the injury is at the same time, but we're talking here about a long-lasting illness, or at least a potentially long-lasting illness, and it seems like you do get into that area of the law that talks about, don't sue too soon because your injury might get worse. On the other hand, you've got to sue within the statute of limitations. So you sue for your personal injury and get some damages, but meanwhile, the illness goes on and on and on and on. And doesn't it at some point become too stale? I'm just trying to figure out what's at the bottom of this.
That
seems to me like a fairly fair to say that perhaps is the answer.
It's interesting in reading the cases that those concerns are not expressed as part of the court's rationale.
It would be nice to go back and look at the...
It would be really nice to go back, and I think that's why we have to go forward. I think that ultimately, these are very old cases. You have seen the erosion of those concepts, as we pointed out in our brief. I'm going to mangle this, but it's the Gazija case in 1975, where they said, to the extent that old 1921 case Shaw was based in tort, it's wrongly decided. All right. So what does that mean? Well, that's one of the linchpins of Calhoun, was Shaw. It was wrongly decided. So is Calhoun still good law? There's only one place that could really tell us, but this court can, as Justice Dwyer did in his dissent, point out that it appears that the Supreme Court has been telling us that, and that, in fact, that's where we need to go to get the real answer. In order to do that, I think this court can follow Justice Dwyer's lead and say there is an apparent overruling here of this old precedent, and that we need to go forward and get the real word from the deciders. And with that, unless there are further questions from the court, I will submit.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors. As said previously, my name is Sean Morgan. I represent one of the consolidated petitioners in this action, Paramount Supply Company. The estate advocates that this court follow the dissent in Deggs, follow Justice Dwyer. But, Your Honors, there's no reason to do that because the majority in that case was both well-reasoned and it was correct. Counsel used the word topsy-turvy several times, and in doing that, it's this reflection that someone might have to wait, that it's based on this misunderstanding that the wrongful death claim can accrue prior to death. But that's never been our argument. Our argument is that once the decedent engages in a certain course of conduct, in this case it's the running of the statute of limitations, remember, we have a decedent in this case who learned he had terminal mesothelioma in 2006, brought and litigated a cause of action to trial and to verdict, conducted discovery in that original case, knew he had claims against other defendants, made a choice not to bring those claims, and then only upon remand decides now to bring those again. That's not topsy-turvy. That's a reflection of the state of Washington's longstanding rules and policy preferences for finality. I'm sure there was defendants in that case that had settled. There's nothing in the estate's interpretation of the law that prevents the estate from resuing those defendants. That would create chaos, that would completely disturb the policy preferences of Washington in favor of finality.
It sounds like your answer to Judge Becker's question is yes, it is this potential dilemma of the stale claim that goes on forever and ever, and we end up with a real conundrum.
Exactly. And that conundrum's important. And it's not a matter of an estate deciding when do I sue now when I learn that the injured party has terminal cancer, or do I wait until after death? That's not the issue, because that's completely illogical and just not based in the reality of these claims. The true nature of the claim, based on the wrongful act of the defendant, is known at that time. Our policy prefers taking action that time. You have inquiry notice. You have a discovery rule that protects you. You take action then. There's no good policy grounds to agree that someone would then delay that action. And, Your Honors, just to let me conclude, the majority in Deggs, it was a well-reasoned opinion, and it affirmed long-standing Supreme Court precedent that is based on reasonable policy. We ask this court to do the same.
Thank you, counsel.